This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Michael Vann of Sacramento State University, but as always, please call me Mike. Today I'm speaking with Professor Greg Huff about World War II and Southeast Asia, Economy and Society Under Japanese Occupation, out with Cambridge University Press in 2020. World War II and Southeast Asia won the Lindart Williamson Prize from the Economic History Association. Greg is a senior research fellow at Pembroke College, University of Oxford. He is the author of The Economic Growth of Singapore, Trade and Development in the 20th Century, and co-editor of and contributor to World War II Singapore, the Chosabu Report on Seonnam-do. Please forgive my Japanese pronunciation. He has a large number of publications in the Journal of Economic History, Economic History Review, Economic Development and Cultural Change, Oxford Economic Papers, Cambridge Journal of Economics, World Development, Modern Asian Studies, and the Journal of Southeast Asian Studies. To say that World War II and Southeast Asia, Economies and Society Under Japanese Occupation, is an impressive achievement is a huge understatement. It is based on years of research in over 24 archives on 3 continents. The book explores how Japan, as part of its plan to build an East Asian empire and secure oil supplies essential for the war in the Pacific, swiftly took control of Southeast Asia. Dr. Huff describes the occupation's devastating economic impact on the region. Japan imposed country and later regional autarky on Southeast Asia, dictated that the region finance its own occupation, and sent almost no consumer goods to Southeast Asia. GDP fell by half everywhere in Southeast Asia, except for Thailand. Famine and forced labor accounted for most of the 4.4 million Southeast Asian civilian deaths under the Japanese occupation. World War II in Southeast Asia presents a new understanding of Southeast Asian history and development before, during, and after the Pacific War. Dr. Huff, Greg, if I may, welcome to New Books in History.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. And so I'm excited to have you on the podcast, as your comprehensive account of the economic and social history of the war in Southeast Asia is certain to reshape the field, and I think our general understanding of the Pacific War. But before we get into the book, let's start with a question about you. You're currently senior research fellow at Oxford. Could you tell us a bit about how you became a scholar of Southeast Asia? And a scholar of Southeast Asia's economic history. I'm curious both about your attraction to the region, but also your development as an economic historian.
Well, I went to the University of Pennsylvania, and Penn had a strong interest in economic history. And my first economics teacher as a freshman was a guy named Dick Duboff, who's still a lifelong friend and read every word of this book. And he had another graduate student friend, Al Fenichel. And Fenichel had written a paper on Burma, a long paper, and he wanted a research assistant. So Duboff put him in touch with me, and of course, I didn't know anything about Southeast Asia or Burma, but I started reading. Then I had at least some knowledge, not really very much, of Southeast Asia. And when I got to LSE as a graduate student, my first supervision meeting was with an economic historian, Jack Fisher, and Halla Mint. And I said I wanted to do Southeast Asia, and they thought, nothing has been done on Singapore. Or that's what Mint said that. And they were keen on Singapore because they liked the idea of a city. Because everything happens in a city except planting crops. So, you know, you come in contact with a lot of topics, industry, population, migration, trade, and so forth. And Mint was always fascinated by barter. I don't think he ever wrote on it, but it fascinated him and the way Southeast Asia tied together. And Singapore was a center of this, so Mint was really, really keen on Singapore. So I started doing Singapore. And in the UK, a dissertation was at least meant to be a publishable piece of work. And so that's how I ended up writing about Singapore. And then I taught economics for a long time. And while I was teaching at economics, I was at ANU as part of Tony Reed's project on Southeast Asia. And I asked Reed, people have written on pre-post 1940 or pre-1940 Southeast Asia and post, and they usually seem to write on one or the other, but no one has done the war in between for all of Southeast Asia. And Reed said, well, that's partly because a lot of people think it couldn't be done. While I was teaching economics, what you need, I suppose, if you want to get ahead in inverted commas, is published journal articles. But at Oxford, I was, for the first time, in a history department, and I had space finally to do the war and to try to bridge the gap in the literature and try to help understand both pre- and post-war periods. That was the attempt at any rate.
Great. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, that is a gap in the literature. And I mean, especially in terms of economics, I mean, I can, off the top of my head, I can think of maybe Nicholas Tarling's book. Is that a sudden rampage about war in Southeast Asia? But the literature is fairly slight, isn't it?
Paul Kratoska has an excellent book on Malaya, but it's really just on Malaya. I mean, it's if you want to know about the war in Malaya, you couldn't do better.
Right. But I'm thinking sort of region-wide studies.
As you say, Tarling, but I don't think there's others.
Interesting. I know that when I teach the war in Southeast Asia, many of my students are completely stunned. They've never even thought about this aspect of World War II, and these are mostly American students. But you know, they think about it in terms of the West Pacific Islands, and then Japan, of course. But there's this whole section that's just blank in their minds, which is ironic, as many of my students in California are of Southeast Asian heritage.
Yes, I've got a student who's going to Stanford. I'm not to do a master's degree in the first instance. California has a real attraction. It's a kind of a nice place to be, I hear.
When it's not on fire.
We've had
a rough couple of years with the fires, but Stanford, Palo Alto is lovely.
Yes, really lovely. It is, isn't it? But I always feel when I'm there, I'm never really dressed good enough to be. I'm never really well enough dressed to be at Stanford. It's so perfect.
Well, I come from a Cal Berkeley family, so I'm just gonna move on from any discussion of Stanford here.
Could I just interject a minute? It was a big project, the book, but so I should really acknowledge, if there's not another point, for so many people who helped. I mean, because we talked about Dutch earlier, and Pierre van der Ing knows more about Dutch economic history or the Indonesian economic history than anyone anywhere in the world. And he just shared so much material with me and overcame that. And I think you know Mike Montesano, who knows, he knows an incredible amount about Southeast. Anything you want to know about Southeast Asia, Mike knows. And he read the book or the manuscript more than once and corrected all sorts of errors about Southeast Asia. So that and, you know, really helped bridge the language gap, which is so difficult in Southeast Asia.
Right. We were chatting about that earlier. I mean, both the incredible linguistic diversity of Southeast Asia, but also the colonial legacy that many archival holdings would be in French in Aix-en-Provence or in Dutch in Leiden. Yeah. Is that where the archives are? Or maybe Amsterdam, I'm not sure, or in the UK or in the United States for the Philippines and Spain prior to 1898. So, your book is such an achievement by pulling together all these existing bodies of literature that have been siloed into nation state thinking or old colonial thinking by the linguistic parameters.
It's kind of you, but I really have to acknowledge how much van der Ing and Montesano helped.
Great. Yeah. That's great. So, I mean, I have to tell you, I'm more than a little embarrassed to say that both during my education and then in my career, I've generally run the other way when I thought what was the ugly little head of economic analysis was popping up, right? I was terrified as a student and, my work is as a cultural historian. However, when I began teaching large world history courses as part of my job, I had to do substantial reading in the field, and I discovered that much of the historiography of world history, and definitely the most valuable books for my thinking about world history and the way I teach world history, were economic histories. Jan Abouleigold's classic Before European Hegemony comes to mind, Chaudhuri's Trade and Civilization in the Indian Ocean, Ken Pomerantz's The Great Divergence. These have all so much shaped my thinking. And I'm now a little embarrassed because when I teach my master's seminar, we actually read a lot of economic history, which was something that I wish I had spent more time when I was in graduate school working in that field. For you, what do you think that economic history does that other subfields don't quite capture? You know, what's the contribution of economic history to our understanding?
History builds on layers. Geography, economic, political, sociological, anthropological, and they interact with each other. You need to understand all the layers and how they interact to get a whole story, to understand history, and then answer the basic historical questions. What happens, how it happens, why it happens. And, can you fully explain all these questions if you don't have economic history? The same as you're telling me about the courses you teach and the reading that you do.
Yeah, I always think of the quote from Karl Marx's 18th Brumaire of Louis Napoleon about humans make their own history, but not in conditions of their own choosing. And that's what, especially like Pomerantz's Great Divergence, really made me understand the economic restrictions that, like, there's only a certain number of choices one can make with these various economic parameters. I had a better sense of that in terms of geography, but it was, you know, relatively late in my sort of development as a historian that I really began to appreciate that economic aspect. And I think your book does a great job with that, because the opening chapters reshaped how I thought about the Pacific War and Southeast Asia's role. So as we move towards the book, could you say a few words about the economic significance of Southeast Asia?
Southeast Asia, well, I suppose even now, but before the war, it's a collection of highly specialized mono economies. And there are places that colonial powers find it convenient to produce a few commodities. And these commodities are fundamental to the global economy. So Southeast Asia fits in. I mean, it's closely integrated with the global economy as a producer of a few specialized commodities. Rice, rubber, tin, and sugar. Those are the main exports. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly mm-hmm. narrow. These are really narrow economies.
And not things that you can subsist upon.
No, that's part of the problem of the war. I mean, you have the food-producing areas, and they are integrated with the non-food-producing areas. But as you said, when the Japanese declare autarky for military reasons, you have a real problem because the non-food-producing areas have specialized so much in non-foods that they can't feed themselves.
And yeah. So when Japan moves into Southeast Asia, initially sort of pushing into French Indochina in 1940, and then with the official invasion after December 7th, 1941, what were Japan's goals in seizing Southeast Asia, be they economic, strategic, political, or there's even some ideological goals, correct?
Well, that is the Japanese story, particularly ideological. I try to make the argument, and I think it's true, that Japan is pressed at home. It's economically pressed, and it has a leadership. It's absolutely true, the political part, with visions of Japan's rightful place in the world. But to deal with economic problems, I mean, and the economic problem is that half of Japan's population is in agriculture, and the Japanese have a very low standard of living, and they need, in a very small area, about the size of your California, and they need to industrialize. Because that's the way you solve an economic problem of raising standards of living when you don't have much land. But to industrialize, they need foreign exchange, and for foreign, you know, because you have to buy raw materials. For foreign exchange, they need to export. But in the 1930s environment of trade restrictions, they're finding it difficult to earn the foreign exchange to buy the raw materials to industrialize. And their solution is to build an empire, create an empire, expand on their mini empire. And they call it the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere. And the idea is that it's large enough and insulated enough from the world economy that Japan can create a yen block and pay in yen China is thinking about creating its own currency block now, or they'd like to. And if you can create, the Greater East Asia Prosperity Sphere, it solves the problem of Japan's development and industrialization, and it solves the problem of an empire and Japan's rightful place in the world.
Right. I mean, there's the prestige component as well. I mean, so economically, what were they thinking that they would get out of Southeast Asia? Was this literally going to fuel the war machine?
Well, the one thing there's no oil. Well, East Asia is badly deficit in oil, and there isn't any oil. There isn't any oil in Japan, and you cannot fight a war even now without oil. So the one thing they really needed was oil, and Indonesia has oil in Sumatra and Borneo at that time, and they thought, well, we have to have war, and we might as well there's only one way to get it, because they were restricted. They had depended on U.S. oil, but then when Cordell Hull cuts off U.S. oil, they feel really pressed and pushed into Southeast Asia. So it's a matter of survival, the way the Japanese see it.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, I think that you make a good point in the beginning that in some ways our geographic thinking may be a little misleading. It seems that Southeast Asia is very close to Japan, but not really. I mean, there's a little thing called the U.S. Navy that manages to survive Pearl Harbor, right? So, well, on the one hand, it's just right there, but maybe the distortions of the Mercator projection and our failure to really understand the difficulty of long-distance maritime transport, that kind of undermines that Japanese strategic thinking,
well,
right?
Yes, although I think the strategic thinking was also that the Pacific coast of the U.S. is even a lot further from Southeast Asia, and how is the United States going to mobilize to fight a war in Southeast Asia? It's so far.
Mm-hmm. And truth is, there's actually relatively little American fighting in Southeast Asia. I mean, MacArthur famously promised he would return, and the United States liberates, reoccupies the Philippines towards the end of the war. But most of the American fighting, ground fighting in World War II, are in these much smaller islands in the island hopping campaign. And there's no real invasion of Southeast Asia.
No, the Pacific War is an air and sea war. Maybe the last air and sea war we'll ever see.
Yeah, that's interesting to think about. And so how is the United States able to disrupt the Japanese economic strategy for exploiting Southeast Asia?
Japan hadn't quite reckoned with U.S. submarine warfare, and Japan had not planned really too much in advance, and so they only had enough merchant tonnage, and obviously a small island, you're absolutely dependent on your merchant marine to feed yourself and for supplies, and Japan had discounted submarine warfare, which was a mistake. and they only went into the war with enough merchant tonnage, just enough if they didn't lose any. But they lost about three-quarters of their merchant tonnage by the end of the war, so it was terrible. They were just cut off.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, those statistics you show on the collapse of the Japanese merchant marine fleet, just astounding. Like, no, there's no way an island nation is going to survive without the ships.
No, it's always was historically the strength of Britain. You know, the Royal Navy right. always came to the rescue.
Right. Right. So, given these economic constraints, do you think that the Japanese war was ever winnable?
Depends what you mean by win. Japan needed a short war, just like Germany needed in World War II. And it might have, given a short war, have obtained some part of Southeast Asia. Maybe that was impossible after Pearl Harbor. But Japan was never going to win a long war. It was just too weak economically. There wasn't any comparison economically with the United States. Japan had 3% of 3.5%, I think, of world capital goods output, and the U.S. had 40%. And if you have capital goods, that's what you make ships and guns and planes with. Japan just couldn't match that.
Yeah, yeah. That comparison between the German need for a quick war, I think, is really enlightening. I mean, when I teach this, when I teach the Second World War and then do the Pacific War, I talk with my students about thinking of this as an Asian blitzkrieg in late 41, 42, and that the idea of blitzkrieg, while, you know, for the 12-year-old boys in the audience, you know, the blitzkrieg seems this yes. big, powerful thing. But it's a strategy of a weak power, right? You need to come in and force, finish the war really quickly because you can't win the long war. And that's obviously what happens to Germany and also to Japan.
Yes.
You know, thinking about the region as a whole, how did the Japanese administer the various parts of Southeast Asia, and what were their assumptions? Could you say a few words about the division between occupied Southeast Asia between the army and the navy?
Well, the army and the navy, as I'm sure you know from teaching in Japan, were in competition with each other. They didn't fight a war, and you have an army and navy that are in competition and don't speak to each other. So Southeast Asia was divided between the army and the navy to avoid conflict. But in fact, the army administered most of Southeast Asia, with the navy in a subsidiary role. So the army had Java, Malaya, British Borneo, the Philippines. And that really just left the navy in total control of some of the outer islands of Indonesia.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
And you argue that the Japanese strategy was fundamentally flawed, and Southeast Asia wouldn't give the economic success for the Japanese war machine that was hoped. What did the Japanese war planners get wrong?
Well, Japanese didn't really plan too much, so I'm not sure about war planners.
Okay.
they didn't know much about Southeast Asia, and they had only decided finally to invade Southeast Asia in the summer of 1941. And Japanese weren't trained in Southeast Asia, and they didn't really plan. They said they were told by some intelligence sources and academics that played sort of war games that they couldn't possibly win, but the politicians, if you have a dictatorship, said, well, we must win. You know, what is the alternative? We will win.
And you got a great quote in the book from a Japanese official. I don't know if it was in the Navy or the Army, but I think it was maybe the Navy. It was in Outline Indonesia, and saying that he really understood what a colonial economy meant at that point, and how much of the basic goods were imports, and how little the region produced. And I remember that passage. It was just, again, this eye-opening moment for the Japanese official on the ground who's supposed to be running this project, realizing that, we don't understand what's going on here at all.
They really had not thought too much about Southeast Asia. You're absolutely right.
So the book is organized thematically rather than geographically. Could you say a few words about why you chose that organization?
Well, I thought maybe it was clunky to do one chapter, one country, then the next. That you needed to see the region as a whole, as part of the global order. So I preferred to do thematically. Other people might want to do chapter country by country, but I tried to interrelate and look at themes. I think because I've always thought that Southeast Asian studies narrowed itself just by looking at one country or another.
Yeah, I'm in complete agreement with you on that point, and I think that is an issue in the field. And you mentioned you worked with Tony Reed, and you know his work was so fundamental and really encouraging many of us to look at Southeast Asia as a field and break down these nation state parameters. So the book's organized into 10 chapters. We've already sort of talked about what's in the first chapter, the main argument about Japanese weakness and being projected into Southeast Asia. The next chapter is on the administration and various forms of social control in Japanese occupied Southeast Asia. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, Japan is, you know, this gets back to your point about economic weakness. Southeast Asia has a population twice Japan's. It's 1.7 million square miles. Japan is already pressed in China. How do you run and control these diverse societies? And the Japanese use three methods, which I suppose any occupying power has: a mixture of terror, and the terror was truly terrible, incorporating elites. So you create Laurel in Philippines, and Bama in Burma, and Pibin in Thailand, and basically you rule through existing administrations and elites. And thirdly, you control food. And I think that really hasn't been brought out in Southeast Asian studies enough. I found that about 130,000 Singaporeans, about 38% of the population, depended on the Japanese for food. I have a student now who's doing collaboration in Singapore, and his argument is that when you look at it, at some level, practically everyone collaborated in Singapore, collaborated with the Japanese because they were dependent on the Japanese for food. Depends how you define collaboration. Absolutely. That's not easy.
Right. Part, just some form of participation in order to survive, right? Yeah, that food as a tool of control in wartime is, I think, a really important contribution. How about the financing for Japan's occupation? Well,
you have to finance wars. We see that in Ukraine now. You're trying to stop Russia from financing the war, but in when you occupy an area, you want to finance your war. You can do it by taxation, or selling bonds, or printing money. And Japan really, taxes depended on exports. Exports collapsed, so you couldn't tax. There wasn't really a developed financial market, so you couldn't sell bonds, and that left printing money. And so you get the banana money and the Mickey Mouse money, and Japan.
These were the slang terms for the money, right? The Mickey Mouse money was in the Philippines. Yes. And the banana money was this in Malaya?
That's right.
Yes.
It has pictures of banana plants. You can buy, Japan printed so much, you know, and if you want to buy this occupation script, it's very cheap. The cheapest currency from currency dealers you can buy because there's so much of it. But through finance, Japan transfers a lot of resources, well, not just through finance, to themselves. I think that it's often stressed how Thailand, how they were basically left alone during the occupation. But I had a graduate student, Punarat, and we have an article just coming out in the Financial History Review. Thailand transferred about a fifth of its, in real resources, actual resources, a fifth of its GDP to Japan through the way Japan financed the war. It's really important. You have to if you're going to have a war, you have to be able to pay for it.
Right, and Japan's getting Southeast Asia to pay for it through these various mechanisms.
Yes, through finance. Well, if you print script, if you print your own money, it allows you to buy resources, but it costs just what it costs to print. So you're obtaining resources practically for nothing, just the cost of printing. And it works well. governments do it now, but money is a confidence game. You know, if you print too much of it, people lose confidence, and then you get the inflation and hyperinflation you had in Southeast Asia.
Right, right. And what was the impact on the occupation on national product and trade? This is your fourth chapter in the book.
Well, really the fourth and fifth chapter, establishing what happened to GDP or gross domestic product, or if you want to call it gross national product, almost the same thing. I don't think it's generally realized how much that contracted. I mean, we worry about a contraction of 5% in GDP or 10% is a catastrophe. Southeast Asian, as you said at the beginning, GDP or national product falls by half everywhere except Thailand. This It's absolutely catastrophic. It's the greatest macroeconomic contraction in modern history. It's just remarkable. And really all the chapters do is substantiate that, tracing it through the collapse of transport and public services and what manufacturing Southeast Asia had. And I suppose we've talked about comparing, and that's the theme, the collapse. But then really the only way you can substantiate it, because it differs in different countries, is to do in the chapters on a country basis. So it isn't entirely thematic.
Well, I was really struck in the observations in, is it maybe chapter 5, about transportation. And having spent a fair amount of time in Indonesia and traveling around Indonesia on various boats, the way that completely collapsed. Yeah. The Dutch lines that were connecting the islands just are gone, and it's a return to, I guess, small prows and what have you. Could you say a few words on that?
Yes, and the same thing in the Philippines.
Another archipelago nation.
Well, that's right. I mean, they're absolutely dependent on the only way to get from one island to the other is by boat. And of course, transport collapses on land too. I mean, people, all that's left are rickshaws and bullock carts and cararata, or horse carriages in the Philippines, or horse carriages elsewhere. It's what you get when you get a collapse of 50% in national product. You're back in 1870.
Right. Yeah. Deindustrialization, and you note that in Batavia now Jakarta, the petchak drivers are having to use wooden wheels, and you have this sort of, again, deindustrialization of these basic forms of transportation.
Yes, although it's really a lack of import. I mean, it brings home how little Southeast Asia had it was so specialized, it didn't have the industry that it depended on imports for almost everything, all basic products, and of course all things like tires, and so you make tires of wood or try to make them of solid rubber.
And matches, you talk about in the Philippines, people trying to split matches in half to get them to last longer. Did I get that right?
I've often wondered how you can do that very effectively. Some people go back to flint and stone.
Yeah. So just all, I mean, and this is the Southeast Asian economic system is, of course, structured prior to the war by the colonial empires, who have used the region for extraction for their own purposes and for selling their own, exporting their industrial goods.
Yes, but structured too because of the global economy. It's a comparative advantage of Southeast Asia is in these few products, and they specialize so entirely and rely and use that money to buy imports that they do, you know, as we know. I mean, there was a handicraft industry, but and there's still a handicraft, and you still make some textiles, but Southeast Asia, not generally recognized, I think. Everywhere in Southeast Asia, the economies depended for their textile consumption, for about 3/4 of their textile consumption on imports. So when you don't have imports, you know, clothing wears out. I, I, I thought about that in relation to your work on rats, you know. Did you notice in in the book that people start wearing, because they don't have any clothing, start wearing gunnies for clothing, and the Japanese threatened with rats, as Southeast Asia does have a tendency to be, give a pair of gunny shorts as a prize for 15 rat tails.
Yep. In any rat moment in Southeast Asian history, well, I get very excited.
Did you notice in Burma when in Rangoon when there's a plague associated with rats, every person has to deliver a rat tail, you can be badly beaten if you don't deliver a rat tail. Well, of course, specialization, a market develops in rat tails. You know, easier to buy one than go out and get your own rat.
Yep. And then it can lead to the black market in
rat tails.
And smuggling and illicit production. So what was the impact on consumer goods? I mean, this is kind of an obvious question here. What sort of shortages were induced, and were there any possibilities of substitutions?
This is the
next chapter, chapter six.
Humans are very inventive. It's a remarkable range of substitutes when you don't have anything. And I suppose that was a fun chapter to do, because you don't realize how many things can be made. Well, you have rubber and rice and sugar in abundance. All the things, so that's basically what you can use to make things out of. So you make you distill rubber but you don't have petrol or gasoline, I guess. You make rubber oil to run cars on. You have coconuts in the Philippines. You use coconut husks to fuel the power stations. You distill rice or sugar to make a sort of a fuel. You run cars on charcoal. You make boats and horseshoes and canteens and rice cookers, asphalt for airport runways out of rubber. They're very imperfect substitutes, but it was a fun chapter. You wouldn't have quite believed all the things you can substitute for.
Right. It makes me think of Paris during the German occupation as well, and the various mechanisms that the French resorted to power their vehicles. So while that was a fun chapter, chapter 7 and 8 are much less fun. These were really, for me, really painful chapters to read. I mean, having worked in Vietnamese history, obviously I know the famine of 1945 very well and just how truly horrific that was. So in chapter 7 and 8, you look at food and famine in Southeast Asia, that's in chapter 7. And then chapter 8, you get into food and living standards in the cities of Southeast Asia. So could you talk about the collapse of food and the famines?
Well, I do talk about the Vietnamese famine. I try in chapter 7 to look beyond. Southeast Asia is so divided regionally, ethnically, and class, and so not everyone suffers. Most Southeast Asians end up malnourished to a greater or lesser degree. But for example, in Malaya, the Chinese do better than the Malays, and the Malays do better than the Indians. Malays fishermen on the East Coast suffer, but much less so on the West Coast of Malaya. Lower, and you don't realize quite how integrated Southeast Asia is, or at least I didn't. Lower Burma and Middle Burma depend on one another. And of course, as you were, I think, probably about to point out, Tonkin and North Annam depend on Cochin China for rice, and when a series of typhoons stops that rice, you get the Vietnam famine. As I'm sure you know, and I'm not sure how many people how. It's the greatest famine in world history. I mean, I know 30 million people died in China, or in modern history. I'll qualify. World history is a long time. If you've got to look at famines as percentage of the people in a given population that die. So 30 million in China, or 7 million in Ukraine in the 30s, is more people than Vietnam, but, obviously.
It's a larger population base. Yeah. And one of the things that I talk about with my students is that when we look at the history of famine, we need to, of course, recognize the deaths. But for every death, you're going to have dozens more people who narrowly escaped death. But went through prolonged periods of malnutrition, and especially for developing bodies, children and young adults. I mean, this would be lifelong implications for this prolonged period of malnutrition.
Absolutely, Mike, and not just lifelong, but for individuals, but for the economy. People tend to be less productive. There's in economic history now, people look at events like the Dust Bowl in the 1930s and in the middle United States, and you can trace these people and generally find out how much the long term suffering. I'm not sure how you would do for Vietnam, but if you could, I'm sure you would find it.
Yeah. And that context of the famine is absolutely essential for understanding the tumultuous political events of the next few years for Vietnam. The chapter 9 is on labor in Japan. And of course, we have the famous railway construction, fictionalized in David Lean's Bridge on the River Kwai, which, one of the great films of World War II, obviously. But could you talk to us a bit about the Japanese use of labor?
Well, you, in economics, it's kind of obvious to anyone, you substitute the cheap factor for the dear or expensive factor. And for Japan, labor was practically free, or almost free, and unlimited. So you use labor extensively to build not just the railways, but airfields and defense installations. And you get incredibly high death rates. You need to look at death rates as a per track, railway track kilometer. And we know It's about 215 deaths for every kilometer of the Thailand-Burma railway built. But it is, and it's even more astounding when you look at the central Sumatra and railways in Java, where they were close to 400 deaths per kilometer. It really astounding.
And who are these laborers? I mean, the image we get from the David Lean film is British POWs, but that's a small percentage. Who else is being pressed into service here? And are they being forced? Is it are there economic inducements? Are some of these recruited laborers?
Some are recruited. Some are pulled off the street. Some are told they could see a film, and then when they get inside the cinema, locked in and taken to the railway. But there's three times as many Asians as Europeans that working on the and for the other railways, almost all Asians, three times as many Asians as Europeans on the Thailand-Burma railway, but six times as many Asian deaths.
Even greater. And are they Thai, ethnic Chinese,
well,
South
not so
Asian?
Much Thai. Thailand, mm-hmm. I mean, Thailand transferred a lot of its national income to Japan. But it was pretty much left alone, compared to the rest of Southeast Asia. So a lot of the laborers are taken from Malaya, and Ba Ma Sweat Army sends about 91,000 come from or 92,000 from Burma, and 91,000, so 183,000 in all from Malaya, Java, and Indochina.
Mm-hmm. And I know in the post-colonial Indonesian nationalist narratives, this factors very heavily. If you go to Monas, the national monument Sukarno built in central Jakarta, and you look at the bas relief showing Indonesian history, there's depictions of exploitation under the Dutch, but then there's a huge section for suffering under the Japanese occupation and the forced labor. And in some ways that rivals, like those 3 years rival the 300 years of Dutch exploitation, at least in the representation in the iconography.
That's interesting. And I stayed in the hotel opposite that monument, I think, I missed that.
The Borobudur, yeah. Oh, you need to go to Monas and look at the bas relief around the base there. It's fascinating. And it's like so much of that Sukarno and later Suharto era narrative, it hasn't been revised. It's still the old narrative.
Maybe as a cultural historian, you picked that up and I missed it. I get to
go to museums and look at monuments. I don't have to deal with the numbers, except for when I'm counting dead rats. Then I have to deal with the numbers. So the last chapter is costs and lessons of the war. What are some of your conclusions here?
The war cost Japan about 40 times as much as anything it obtained from Southeast Asia. Southeast Asia was so global. It was globalized and served the world economy, and Japan's economy was so small they couldn't use in the quantity Southeast Asia produced rubber and tin, really couldn't use any of it. I mean, maybe it was valuable. They denied it to the Allies, but then the Allies developed synthetic rubber.
Mm-hmm. And the petroleum was one of the big goals, but mm-hmm. Allied attacks on shipping lines destroy that.
That's right. So by March 1945, an oil tanker from Singapore to Japan was essentially a suicide mission.
Yeah, yeah. So the occupation, which was supposed to be this economic lifeline for the weak economy of Japan, actually worsens Japan's economic situation during the war. Am I understanding that right? As a drain.
Well, it is a drain. If Japan was going to use Southeast, and they try to do this, it would need to reconfigure Southeast Asian economies, and particularly before the war, Japan depended on the United States for oil and cotton. So Southeast Asia would have to be reconfigured to produce cotton, but you can't get around geography. You grow a little cotton in Thailand and northern Burma, but you basically can't produce. It's not a tropical crop.
Yeah, it's mostly coming from South Asia, right? From what's now Pakistan.
Well, yes, or the southern United States.
Yeah, okay, American imports too, yeah. Well, you've been really generous with your time, but I've got two more questions before I let you go. First, can you suggest two books to our listeners related to our conversation?
Well, you mentioned Tarling's book, A Sudden Rampage. That's a fairly short book. It gives you a kind of an introduction and overview. Paul Kratowska's book on the Japanese occupation is very good on Malaya. He spent a long time researching that. But beyond that, as you were suggesting earlier, or almost suggested, or essentially said, all history is comparative. So, you can read about the war in World War II in China or Europe. You run into some of the same thematic problems. Except Germany's awfully efficient, It transfers about half of French national income to Germany in one way and another.
Yeah. And as I understand it, one of Hitler's preoccupations was to keep the home front as happy as possible, having witnessed what happened in the Great War and the collapse of the home front.
Yes, which was a problem for Germany because in war, you need to transform your economy from consumer production to military production. So you need to be able to cut back on consumer goods. And Hitler didn't want to do that. And the German economy never really transferred to war production. That was a problem in Japan, too. They never really... Japanese starved, and there probably would have been a famine in Japan by the autumn of 1945. But Japan never really cut back on the share of consumption to shift into military goods. But Hitler, as you say, Hitler didn't want to do that.
Right. Yeah, and this is, again, for someone who did not really engage economic history when he was receiving his training. These are such important parameters for all the political and military decisions. And I value these insights so much for trying to understand the war. So finally, what are you working on now, and what could we hope to see from you next?
One shouldn't say what one's working on, because it may be one of those books that never gets finished, you know. you don't want to do those. But what I'll be bold. What I'm trying to do is an economic history of Southeast Asia since 1870. So connect it with the war and take it right up to 2020, or and see if you can write an economic history of Southeast Asia. I have a chapter that Robert Cribb is editing volume two. They're doing a new Cambridge history, which I'm sure you know about. And I think they're talking about this at the Association of Asian Studies meeting. And I have a chapter in there. Well, the books haven't come out yet. Some of the chapters may still be written, with some of the themes of that, how you try to connect Southeast Asian history and look for parallels between the pre-war and post-war periods. So that's what I'm trying to do anyway.
Great. Well, I look forward to seeing that. And if you're looking for a subtitle for that economic history of 1870 to 2020, there's always From Colonies to COVID.
It's got a nice alliteration.
Nice alliteration, yeah. Okay. Well, Dr. Grekov, thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Mike, I've listened to your podcast before. It was a genuine pleasure to be on one. Thank you so much.
Great, thank you. This has been a conversation with Greg Huff of Pembroke College, University of Oxford, about World War II in Southeast Asia, Economy and Society under Japanese Occupation, out with Cambridge in 2020. I'm Michael Vann of Sacramento State University, and this has been an episode of New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. Thank you for listening.